The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to conclude our conference with this final panel. Thank you for waiting so long all day for this. It's kind of unfortunate that your concluding panels are often the ones who kind of get the most, sometimes the most important information out, kind of in this case, telling us the way forward conceptually with terrorist tensions. But unfortunately, it's also where we tend to lose a lot of our audience as they have to go after attending some of the earlier ones that have been building up to this point. But this afternoon's panel, like the other ones, is extremely star-laden. And I'll let Professor Marcus do the introductions for our excellent panel this afternoon, excellent speakers. But I would like to very quickly thank all those who have participated so far, and especially the Washington College of Law and our special events folks who are the ones responsible for all the logistics and make these events actually possible. So I thank them and also the other students, Chris Chaplick, Jensen Grant, Solomon Shinnerock, and Eric Roscoe, who helped me organize this conference and get things going with it. So this afternoon's panel is on our new legal concepts needed for terrorist-related detentions, or as we've heard recently, past year in the news, what's the way forward on terrorism? I will be moderated by Professor Daniel Marcus, who is a professor here at the Washington College of Law. Previously to joining the faculty here, he was the general counsel for the 9/11 Commission investigating the terrorist attacks. Before then, he's held a series of senior-level positions in the Department of Justice, including being Associate Attorney General, as well as working in the White House General Counsel's office. He also worked for a number of years as a partner in the Washington law firm of Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, and also worked during the Carter administration as a Deputy General Counsel in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and General Counsel of the Department of Agriculture. He received his LLB from Yale Law School. I didn't know they gave LLBs out in this country.
You could send in your LLB with $25 and have it transformed into a JD, but I was too cheap to do it.
And he also received his BA from Brandeis University. So, Professor Marcus.
By the way, panel members, you have the option of speaking from your chair or coming up here. We law professors, even late in life law professors, love to stand up. Let me briefly introduce the members of our panel. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak, which is not quite the order that they're sitting in. First is going to be Ben Wittes. Ben is a fellow and research director in public law at the Brookings Institution. A lot of you have probably, I don't know how many of you have read his wonderful new book, Law and the Long War. But if you haven't, I'll put in another plug for it here. It's a really thoughtful and elegantly written book. And even if you don't agree with all the conclusions, and you probably won't agree with all of them, you'll find it a very worthwhile enterprise. You probably have read his stuff earlier without realizing it. For a number of years, he was an editorial writer for the Washington Post and wrote a lot of editorials about legal issues, including issues in the war on terror. Ben is the only non-lawyer on the panel here. But for a non-lawyer, as you will see, if you read his book, he's a hell of a legal analyst. Our second panelist is David Reams. David has just started an interesting new enterprise called Appeal for Justice, a nonprofit human rights and civil liberties organization that is going to be a major player, I think, on the Guantanamo issues. Before that, for many years, he was a partner at Covington & Burling, representing on a pro bono basis some of the Guantanamo detainees. And he's still representing some of them, right? Our third panelist is Deborah Colson. who is a senior associate in the Law and Security Program at Human Rights First, which is one of our leading and most active organizations in the human rights field, and they've just published a very good booklet on the detention issues. Deborah has a background as an assistant federal defender at the Federal Defenders of New York, and has also worked in state public defender offices. Finally, you'll see a familiar face. One of our panelists today, Madeline Morris, a professor at Duke Law School, could not make it at the last minute, for which she's very sorry, and we are too. But we have, in her place, David Rivkin, who has graciously agreed to do double duty today and to think of new things to say that he didn't say on the last panel. But we've put him last so he can think about it. Now, you probably have gotten an idea from the program of the scheme of today's program. This is the forward-looking panel that is going to talk about whether we need new concepts, new legal structures, both substantively and procedurally, to deal with the terrorist detention problem. And I think we can see from the earlier panels that what we have today is a mixture, and sometimes shifting back and forth, between a law of war paradigm for the problem of detaining suspected terrorists in this new kind of war, and a criminal law paradigm. And there are problems with both of them, and let me just take a second to sort of summarize what I think we learned from this morning's and this afternoon's earlier panels. I think the major issues with the law of war structure is how you there are quite a few issues, actually. How you define who is an enemy combatant in this new kind of war. What you do about the fact that this war, it's very difficult to predict or define when, if ever, this new kind of war will end. And third, which I guess we didn't talk as much about this, the changing nature of the enemy in this war. When the war started, it was pretty easy to see who the enemy was. It was Al-Qaeda, a sort of clearly defined small organization that had launched and sponsored the attacks, and the Taliban government of Afghanistan, which had harbored and facilitated them and refused to turn them over to us. As the war has gone on, and Al-Qaeda has morphed into a looser confederation of organizations with less central direction, that becomes less clear. On the criminal justice side, we've seen that there are real practical problems with using our regular Article III courts and using the criminal justice system to prosecute suspected terrorists. One of them, which I think hasn't been mentioned much, is that if you use the criminal justice system from the beginning, you forfeit the opportunity to effectively gather intelligence from the people you've captured or arrested. And that's because once someone is arrested and charged with a crime, the full set of rights that Harvey Ryshikov talked about this morning kick in. The other problem, the big problem, of course, and there's much debate about this as to whether it's an exaggerated problem or not, is the problem of whether the classified evidence particularly evidence relating to intelligence gathering, can effectively be used in the criminal justice system, even with the SEPA process that is available. So that I think what this has led to is a lot of talk, an increasing amount of talk about whether we need to design a new system where we sort of forthrightly say we need to have a preventive detention system based on a determination of not only of involvement with terrorism but continued danger, and we need to have a new set of institutions to do that, or we need to use existing institutions to do that. So with that as an introduction, let me turn it over first to Ben.
Thanks very much for the very kind words about the book and the kind introduction. So in panels like this, which I've been appearing on for, as the war on terrorism has gone on, a lot of years now, there's inevitably, in an effort at balance, that you get set up on a kind of a left-right basis in which left is defined not according to politics. Left and right are defined not according to partisan politics or even voting habits or whatever. They're defined according to how broad, if at all, one believes in an extra criminal detention authority for the government in counterterrorism. And in that scheme, I'm inevitably the centrist, because I believe that there should be some, and it should be fairly heavily regulated, that is to say, much more restrictive than the administration has formulated it, and yet still existing, and therefore, that sort of separates me from, in this scheme, the left. And for many years, I was pretty comfortable with this this arrangement. And then in the past couple of years, I've grown less comfortable for the following reason. I've noticed that there's actually a consensus that has developed between the left and the right on some of the very core ideas behind that scheme. And it's a consensus from which I dissent. And so I'm going to lay out the consensus and then talk about why I don't believe in it and why I think that that actually leads you to a different set of policies about how to handle detentions. The consensus goes something like this. One, current law is adequate to address our needs in the detention and incapacitation of terrorists department. That is to say, both sides agree, left and right agree, that there is a place in the world for law enforcement. There's a place in the world for the law of war and the detention authority inherent in the law of war. Very few people disbelieve that there is some. So you have these two zones that are kind of floating out there in space somewhere. They're separate from one another. And the argument, and they're separate, and you can't hybridize them. They don't mix. They really don't overlap with one another. And they're separate. They're non-hybridizable. And the argument between left and right is really an argument about how big they are. That is, is the law of war detention authority this big, and the criminal justice side is this big, or are they, as the administration describes, kind of more equally sized like this? That is to say, you pick somebody up, you kind of have your choice. You can throw them in box number one, or you can throw them in box number two. But the core of the consensus is that we already have the answers in the law. We're just fighting, we're fighting over the size of the boxes and the relative positions of the boxes with each other. It's a sense of the fight as the weight borne by each of these zones. Now, if I sound a little bit impatient with this, it's because I am. I actually don't believe that current law answers our questions. I don't think it optimally addresses either the law enforcement paradigm or the law of war paradigm, amply sort of answers the questions of, how do you handle somebody who's captured abroad who may, probably, likely is a terrorist, but you're not sure and you can't declassify or won't declassify the evidence anyway. I don't think it optimally either system optimally answers the question, how should we think about somebody who's probably a really bad guy, which is realistically the situation that we're dealing with over and over and over again. And when I say probably, that could be 95%, or it could be 51%, or even actually it could be 45%. You know, too high a risk of too bad a guy. I don't think either the criminal law or the laws of war, individually or collectively together, are capable, are well positioned of handling the mess of cases that we are facing. Now, that's not to say they can't be forced to do the work. It's just that they can't be forced to do the work all that well. And so what I believe, rather, is that we in fact do need to hybridize them, that thing that you're not supposed to do that is pushing those two zones together into this other area where you're talking about something different is rather exactly what we need to be talking about doing now. So to put it in a little bit more concrete terms, I think that this is a conflict that partakes of aspects of law enforcement and aspects of warfare, and that fact implies both authorizations and restraints imposed by both bodies of law. I'm talking about creating something new, about dealing with the problem of terrorist detentions as a problem that is not controlled by these prior bodies of law, but for which we're going to have to create institutions and regimes informed by both but controlled by neither that are new. And when you do that, you're talking about institution building by the Congress of the United States. That's the basic starting point here. Now, when I give this talk in front of, again, to go back to that left-right spectrum, left groups, the question is always, well, why do we need extra criminal detention? All right, so let me throw the answer to that out on the table. The answer, to put it very bluntly, is twofold. One is because the number of people that we're going to need to detain and have already needed to detain is significantly in excess of the number of those that we could convict. And I don't mean the number that we are unreasonably going to detain. I mean the number that a reasonably prudent military executive branch is going to detain. Let me give you, now I cannot quantify this, but I can give you a sense of the quantity. So if you look at the current Guantanamo population, which is about 255 people, the military has said that 60 of them have been cleared for release or transfer. So you can knock that number down to about 190 that it feels it needs to continue detaining. It is said that about 80 of them, under the best of circumstances, that is to say, if everything goes according to plan and nothing has gone according to plan, could be tried in military commissions, which means that about 110 people, the government feels, A, it cannot safely release, and B, it feels it cannot put on trial, even in the relaxed procedural confines of a military commission. Now, I'm willing to believe that the government is significantly, you know, either because I really believe it or for purposes of argument, depending on the time of day, frankly, I'm willing to accept that the government is significantly overstating its detention needs. It could safely release some of those people. But there's still a gap. Even if you believe that, you know, only 40 or 50 of them really need to be detained, really pose a threat, you're still talking about a significant group of people whom we could not safely release and whom we could not put on trial, even if you make the rules easy. I think we can also anticipate that we will detain such people in the future. The second reason is sort of less practical and more philosophical. Whether or not we call the war on terrorism a war, it is an international conflict. It's an international conflict in which we use all kinds of tools of warfare. We send predator drones out to shoot missiles at people. You don't do that in a law enforcement context. We deploy military force, etc. So my argument is that one of the things that this conflict has that comes from warfare should be the authority to detain the enemy under some set of rules. When I give this talk to conservative groups, I have exactly the opposite response, which is, why do you want to import a whole lot of process from the criminal law into the traditional law of war zone? And David was, asking many of these questions in a somewhat different context in the last panel. And I think here, too, the answer is because the laws of war just don't quite fit. In fact, they more than just don't quite fit. So let's take two key assumptions of the laws of war, which I think are sort of patently untrue in the context of the war on terrorism. One is, the laws of war sort of assume that there's really no factual ambiguity about who the enemy is. They wear uniforms, et cetera. You capture them along a front. And so there's, when you capture the enemy, there's actually surprisingly little in the laws of war about how you figure out who the enemy is, because it's just assumed that it's a kind of an obvious thing. Well, this is just a ludicrous idea in the current conflict. I mean, one of this is now the other David Reams's clients, who I write about in my book. Based on the public record, you look at this guy, and it is very difficult to see what the basis for his detention is. That's not to say that there isn't some classified basis that gets you there, but I look at this case and I say, geez, this looks like a kid who was teaching the Quran to some guys in Afghanistan. It seems very earnest. You want some process to resolve that dispute. You want it. And that's different from when you catch an enemy soldier who you really have no doubt of who he is, and there's no dispute about it. The second thing is the open-ended nature of the conflict. It's one thing to say we don't know when the war on terrorism is going to end. I don't even know what that means. And so when you're talking about long-term detention of people in a very open-ended, even conceptually open-ended setting, I think there's an argument for a level of process and sort of procedural seriousness in which have some basis for confidence that there's going to be a serious outcome that we can rely upon and a factual record that establishes it. And I'll return to that point in a minute. So it follows, if you take any of this seriously, it follows that we're talking about something new, which is the application of agreed upon rules and a real adjudicatory mechanism and process to detention outside of the context of criminal justice. That is to say, an institutional and a regime that's tailored to our current needs and situation, which is frankly different from anything we or any other country has dealt with before. That is to say, operating worldwide, capturing fairly large numbers of people based on uncertain evidence. And as I say, I think the place to develop this is really in the legislative context. Now, in the book, I sketch out in some detail what I think such a scheme would look like. I'm not going to do that here for time reasons. I'm happy to talk about it later. For present purposes, I think I'll just describe a few principles that this thing, you can call it a national security court, you can call it really, I'm not married to any terminology, sort of whatever you like. But I want the detention that it authorizes to be A, by Article 3 judges. I want it to be honestly, frankly, and openly preventive in nature. We pretend in our system that we don't do preventive detention. It's not true. We do. We do it in a lot of contexts that are less compelling, frankly, than the circumstance of sworn enemies of the country, military enemies against whom Congress has authorized the use of force. And I want it to follow an actively and openly litigated case in which the detainee, with the assistance of counsel, has a genuine opportunity both to confront the government's evidence against him and the government's allegations against him, and also to put on evidence of his own, and critically, that produces a public record that you can actually consult and figure out, is Farouk Abu Ali reasonably detained or not? Or if you can't see, if they have to redact the evidence, at least does Judge X, Y, or Z from the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia think he's reasonably detained? And the pivotal thing to me is that this judgment be at the outset of a detention, not many years later after we have, you know, a litigation over the sort of both the meta habeas and then the habeas itself. I want the government to have the benefit of an ex ante judicial permission for what it's done, and I want the detainee to have the benefit of all of that process right up front. So I'm going to stop there, but that's the sort of broad overview of the picture.
Thank you, Ben.
Hi. I'm glad to be with you. Thanks to the sponsors for inviting me. And I'm particularly pleased to be on such a distinguished panel. I really think the world of Ben and his book, I think the world of the other panelists, but I've just gotten off reading his book. So I think particularly very thoughtful and very balanced. It's hard in the time that we have for me to explain how deeply I disagree with many of the very basic assumptions here. The assumption that just because you supported the Taliban, you're an enemy of the United States. I mean, if you think about where we'd be if that wasn't an assumption, we'd be someplace entirely different. I'll even go so far as to say that if you assume that anybody who supports the aims of al-Qaeda is an enemy of the United States, I think that, too, has profound implications for the way you look at this system. I also believe that it's a fundamental mistake to view the hatred of America and the aims of Islamic extremism as causeless and irrational and subjective entirely. I think to some extent they are, but I go back to 2001 after 9/11. The New Yorker magazine published an issue with a few short squibs by various prominent people commenting on 9/11. And Susan Sontag, a highly esteemed public intellectual at the time, who died a few years ago, said, you know, this was horrible, it was terrible, it was unforgivable, and it was inexcusable. But we've got to ask ourselves whether there has been anything in the policies of the United States that might have spawned this kind of hatred. Now, I'm not going to blame the United States for what happened on 9/11. That's the farthest thing in my mind to do. But if you actually sit down with some of these people, al-Qaeda supporters, Taliban supporters, which I must say I've done when I've been to Yemen, which is sort of a hotbed of al-Qaedaism, what you hear them say is, we've got three gripes. One is, we want the U.S. military out of the Arabian Peninsula. I don't particularly have a big problem with that. I mean, this is just me speaking, any more than I had a big problem with getting the U.S. out of Indochina. The second is, the U.S. should stop propping up dictators, as in most of the Arab countries. I don't particularly have a problem with that either. The third prong is, Israel has no business being in existence here, at least not in any form that we would recognize, and that I do have a big problem with, for reasons that I don't need to go into here. So what happened was that we took something that actually had a rational and a political basis, even though the way it was expressed was monstrous and unforgivable and inexcusable, and turned it into this sort of vaporous hatred of the United States, evildoers, they want to destroy our way of life and so forth. And that immediately created, sort of in my mind, an irrational sense that we were at war with an ideology, that we were at war with a movement of extremists. And I must say that the whole war paradigm, if you go and look at it over the last 6 years, has been a spectacular failure. There are more terrorists now than there were before 9/11. Al-Qaeda is more widespread. The hatred of the United States is more widespread. Any intellectual justifications you can come up with for saying the war paradigm is a good paradigm, I would just say, look at what it has brought us. If you stop looking at anybody who supported the Taliban against the Northern Alliance, for example, supporting one side in a civil war against the other side, as an enemy of the United States because they supported one side in a civil war against another side, if you don't view them as enemies of the United States, you've got a much different population in Guantanamo. And most of the men who were there are accused in some way or another of support for the Taliban. So I want to just say at the outset that I have very, very basic problems with a lot of the most fundamental assumptions that we're dealing with here. People say to me, are your clients guilty? And I say, guilty of what? The ones who actually took up arms or allegedly took up arms or allegedly injured Americans are being tried before the military commissions. Most of the other men who are in Guantanamo did not take up arms against the United States. Few of them were captured by the United States. And most of them are held there on the basis of allegations by other prisoners or statements extracted by them, in many cases, by torture. So you're dealing with a situation of very little direct evidence and with widespread claims of torture which are all too credible. And to some extent, one of the thoughts that I had about Ben's book is that Ben very, very, in a very sophisticated way, matches up statements by the prisoners in their administrative hearings with the government's allegations and says, well, you know, there's a match here to this extent, and so we're not really disputing anything. But in many of those cases, the men claimed that they had been tortured, and their accounts matched what the government's allegations are. And in many cases, the government's allegations are based on what they said. So the fact that they came forward to an administrative hearing and repeated what they had already told their interrogators under coercive circumstances doesn't do very much for me. Okay, that's part one. Part two is that this whole discussion is very interesting, but to me it has an academic and an unreal flavor to it. It seems to me that we're spending most of our time talking about what should have been done after 9/11. If you were looking forward from 9/11, what kind of architecture would have been right to create? The situation now where we're discussing all these things reminds me of a great magazine that I read many years ago called the Journal of Irreproducible Results. And what that magazine had, my favorite issue, on the front cover was a plate of spaghetti. And inside the magazine, it had about 2 pages of an equation that predicted that plate of spaghetti. Now, obviously, we're never going to have that plate of spaghetti again. And so the equation is kind of pointless. How does that tie in here? I don't think that the United States is going to be bringing enemy combatants to Guantanamo in the future. I think that they may bring high-value detainees that they want to try before military commissions. But according to the Washington Post, I think it's the Post, don't be offended if there are any Times reporters here, the U.S. for the last couple of years has had a program of picking up enemy combatants and simply sending them back to their home countries. Second of all, a lot of enemy combatants are now being sent to American prisons or American-run prisons or proxy-run prisons in Afghanistan, far beyond the reach of the U.S. courts as a practical matter. And so when we're really talking about a construct for enemy combatants, we're really thinking in terms of what happened in Guantanamo, and I don't think that future administrations are going to make the same mistake, and I think that even the Bush administration learned from its mistakes. So to that extent, these programs for administrative detention and preventive detention have a slightly unreal feel for me. Now, the third part of it is what to do. I will say, having been litigating these cases now for over 4 years, and having watched the litigation, and having watched drag on since February 2002, the one thing I'm sure of is that litigation, unguided litigation, is the most inefficient and ineffective way to develop the rules here. Right now, the Supreme Court has just said in the Boumediene case that the men have substantive enforceable rights, but we're not going to say what those rights are in habeas cases. We're going to leave it to the lower courts to work out. The Post had a really good editorial on this a couple of days ago. Now we're fighting with the government over what should be the standard of proof. Should there be discovery? Can you look beyond the evidence that the government seeks to introduce? And all of this is going to mean endless litigation. And maybe we're right, and maybe we're going to win, but I'll be surprised if we win in my lifetime. And meanwhile, these men are going to sit there languishing in Guantanamo. I don't think
that's not yours.
Unless the U.S. can work out repatriation agreements. So to that extent, I'm sympathetic to the call for Congress to set up rules to govern this litigation. I'd also, of course, I suppose, given my predilections, thought of the courts as the sort of last resort for fairness and justice, because I grew up believing in the courts as a counter-majoritarian force, a force that would stand up for the rights of the individual and the rights of fairness and so forth. But now that Reagan's program of stocking the D.C. Circuit with conservative justices has really reached its full fruition, I don't think, and now that we're a vote away on the Supreme Court from a deeply conservative judicial body at the top, I don't place so much faith in the courts as the ultimate hope for what we're doing. And even if they were, it's going to be years and years of litigation. So I'm sympathetic to the idea of Congress setting some rules for the litigation of these cases. But even there, it's not a particularly appetizing prospect because of the political atmospherics that surround legislation, any legislation about the war on terror. I went to college just when a book was being published by a legal philosopher named John Rawls. And Rawls, his book was called A Theory of Justice, said that we should think about law and justice in the following way. Say, consider yourself in the original position, which is the label he used for it. You've just been born, or you're just about to be born. You don't know where you're going to be born. You don't know who your parents are going to be. You don't know what life is going to bring for you. You don't know where you'll stand when you're 20, when you're 30, when you're 50, whether you'll be poor, whether you'll be rich, whether you'll be powerful, whether you'll be powerless, etc. And you're asked to design a legal system, knowing that there's a possibility that you will be subjected to that legal system at its worst. That's kind of the standpoint from which I come in judging the fairness of a legal system. Would I feel that it was fair to subject myself to the system? I don't mean that in a trivial sense, because obviously I'd never be guilty, and everything being done to me was unfair. But I mean, in the abstract, think about whether the system that's being proposed is a system that you feel it would be fair for you to be subject to. I submit that many of the proposals being floated now, if applied to Americans by other governments, we'd be screaming at the top of our lungs. They were unfair. They were unjust. It's true that I really hate the premier of Nepal. Does that make me an enemy of Nepal? Of course not. I mean, I'm sitting here in the United States. If I had a dagger and the premier of Nepal was here, I'd slice his throat off. Does that make me an enemy of Nepal? No, it just makes me somebody who hates the premier of Nepal. So I think I'll end there and just say that my...
Adam, thank you very much for having me here. I have really enjoyed today. I've learned a lot. It's been really interesting. So I appreciate the opportunity to come. When Ben began, he began with sort of the premise that we need a new system because the system that we have, the existing law that we have, is inadequate. And so we should create a system of preventive detention. Sometimes it's also referred to as a national security court to handle terrorism cases because they are unique and our law is inadequate at this point to handle them. And the organization that I work for, Human Rights First, realized sort of about a year ago that no one had actually done any sort of rigorous empirical analysis of the system that we have. And its ability to handle terrorism cases. And that creating some sort of brand new scheme of preventive detention or a brand new national security court is going to be expensive. It's going to be controversial. It's going to result in a lot of litigation. There's no doubt about that. And that before we do that, we should test the system we actually have and see if it works. And so Human Rights First asked two former federal prosecutors, Rich Zabel and Jim Benjamin, who are both now partners at the law firm of Akin Gump, we asked them if they would study the criminal justice system for us and if they could tell us whether it works in detaining and trying terrorist suspects. And so they spent about a year doing this for us as a pro bono effort. They tried to gather all of the international terrorism cases that have been prosecuted in the criminal justice system since the early 1990s and take a look at them. And they actually identified about 120 cases, 107 of which have been prosecuted since 9/11. And if that doesn't sound like a big number to you, you can compare that to the military commissions at Guantanamo, where there's been one trial since 9/11, and where not one suspect who's implicated in the 9/11 attacks themselves has actually been tried yet. So 107 cases prosecuted in the federal system is quite a huge number. And what Rich and Jim did is they took a look at those cases very closely. They took a look at the docket sheets. They took a look at all the motions that were filed. They read through trial transcripts. They spoke with judges and attorneys about the cases, and they focused in particular on those aspects of the criminal justice system that people have identified as weak or inadequate in terrorism cases. And they did this so that it wouldn't be a purely academic question, so that it would be a practical, empirical question. And what they found is that the criminal justice system is actually very capable of handling these cases. And not only is it capable of handling these cases, but it's capable of doing it without sacrificing our national security interests and with balancing those interests with fairness and due process. So I won't focus on every aspect that they studied. We have our report here, and it would be great to take a look at it. But I will, Professor Marcus raised two potential weaknesses in the criminal justice system when he gave his introduction. And so we can talk a little bit about those. The first is he said, well, you know, in the criminal justice system, you forfeit the opportunity to gather intelligence because someone is assigned a lawyer once they're arrested. And once they're assigned a lawyer, that's it. You're not going to be able to gather intelligence from them. And what Rich and Jim ended up finding is that, in fact, many suspects with lawyers end up cooperating because it's in their best interest to do so. And as someone who was a criminal defense lawyer for about 10 years, I can tell you from my own experience that many of my clients ended up cooperating at my suggestion because it was in their best interest to do so. They were going to get a better deal if they ended up cooperating than they would have if they didn't say anything at all. So the idea that giving somebody a lawyer cuts off the potential to gather intelligence from them is just inaccurate when you actually study the real cases. The other question that Professor Marcus raised is whether it's possible to introduce classified evidence during criminal trials, whether it becomes difficult, whether that's a complication. And I think what Rich and Jim found is that CIPA, which is the Classified Information Procedures Act, actually does an adequate job of balancing the government's national security interest with the defendant's due process rights in several different ways. One of the provisions in CIPA requires defense counsel who's going to receive classified information to get a security clearance before receiving that information. There's another provision in CIPA which requires, in certain instances, summaries or redacted versions of the evidence to be provided to the defendant and to defense counsel rather than reveal the classified information. So that there are mechanisms for protecting our national security and still admitting evidence in court. Another thing that Jim and Rich found is that even when classified evidence has been introduced in criminal cases, there has never been a security leak. Many of the people who advocate national security courts and administrative detention fear that there will be security leaks, that classified information will be revealed in court and that could threaten our national security. That has never happened in the past. So another issue that is raised is whether our criminal justice system is adequate to detain people who present a potential threat to the United States. And in studying this issue, we found that there are existing mechanisms within the law to adequately detain people, both within criminal law and with the assistance of the law of war and immigration law. Within criminal law, the Bail Reform Act obviously permits you to detain somebody who's been charged with a criminal offense if they either present a flight risk or a potential danger to the community. There's also the material witness statute, which I think Mr. Loftman referred to on the earlier panel, which permits the detention of a material witness if there's a potential that that person may flee. Outside the criminal justice system, there's immigration law, which permits the detention of a non-citizen if there's a potential that they've committed an immigration violation or if they're suspected of terrorist activity. And what Rich and Jim found is that these mechanisms, in combination with law of war detention, which does apply and is permissible in certain circumstances, is sufficient, that there is no need for a system, a new system that we create from scratch when these mechanisms have sufficiently worked to detain potentially dangerous people. So the next thing I wanted to address is whether this whole notion that we should be treating terrorist suspects as warriors rather than as criminals is a good idea. And I think that that approach has actually backfired. I think that it's bad counterterrorism strategy to treat terrorist suspects as warriors rather than as criminals. Labeling the Guantanamo combatants, for example, as combatants in some sort of a war on terror actually ceded an advantage to them because it supported their claim that they are engaged in some larger battle against the United States. And any policy of preventive detention would pose the same problems on U.S. soil. And I think you can contrast that with the federal criminal justice system, in which we treat terrorist suspects just as criminals, not as warriors, and that actually lowers their stature, and that actually lowers their importance. And one example that I would give is a comparison of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed with Ramzi Youssef. Ramzi Youssef is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew. He was prosecuted in connection with the first World Trade Center bombing case. And he was tried, he was convicted, and he is now serving life in prison, in a federal prison in the United States. Compare that with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is in Guantanamo, who celebrated his warrior status that we gave him during his combatant status review tribunal, who celebrated the fact that we had labeled him an enemy combatant. And if he is ever tried and convicted by military commission, that conviction will be hotly contested and it will be litigated for years. So this notion of making Khalid Sheikh Mohammed into a warrior has actually backfired. I would also like to read you a quote from the Army Marine Corps counterinsurgency manual, because I think that it's pretty revealing. This is a counterinsurgency manual that was drafted actually by General Petraeus, and it incorporates lessons learned by our military in their counterterrorism operations. And what they say is that in order to gain the support that we need to confront counterinsurgency or to confront insurgency threats, we must send a message to the insurgents that we are committed to the rule of law and that we are committed to human rights. And this is a direct quote. It says, "Effort to build a legitimate government through illegal action, including unlawful detention, torture, or punishment without trial, are self-defeating, even against insurgents who conceal themselves as criminals." And I think that that has certainly proved to be the case at Guantanamo, where prolonged detention without charge and what I would refer to as unjust military commission trials have actually only fueled the recuperative power of our enemy. It's fueled terrorist resentment and it's increased terrorist recruitment. So I do not think it is good counterterrorism strategy to call KSM or anybody else in Guantanamo a warrior rather than a criminal. And I'll just end by saying that I do think that there are serious constitutional questions with creating a system of preventive detention, and that we have to consider this very carefully before we go down this path. The Fifth Amendment states very clearly that we do not deprive anybody of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And among the core elements of the Fifth Amendment are that once you're charged, you receive notice and an opportunity to contest those charges in court. And Ben has said, well, hey, we have preventive detention in this country already. And it is true. There are certain situations where there have been preventive detention in this country, but not for purposes of dangerous alone. There has never been a system of preventive detention in this country for purposes of dangerousness alone. When we detain mentally ill people preventatively, and that in itself is very controversial, it is not simply because they present a danger to the community. It's because they present a danger to the community, and in addition, they are mentally ill and have no control over their actions. And the Supreme Court has been very clear about that the preventive detention of mentally ill people is permissible and constitutional, both because they present a danger and because they don't have control over their actions. If they were merely to present a danger and not have also a mental illness, that preventive detention would not be permissible. Even if some sort of a system did pass constitutional muster, we have to think about whether this is the road we want to go down. I feel very seriously that this would undermine our core American values of liberty, of due process, of presumption of innocence, and these are principles that are embedded in our cultural and legal traditions, and they are not ones we should do away with lightly. So I will leave you with a quote that I think was referred to earlier. This is from Justice Scalia's dissent in Hamdi. And Justice Scalia writes, "The very core of liberty secured by our Anglo-Saxon system of separated powers has been freedom from indefinite imprisonment at the will of the executive. It is unthinkable that the executive could render otherwise criminal grounds for detention non-criminal merely by disclaiming an intent to prosecute or by asserting that it was incapacitating dangerous offenders rather than punishing wrongdoing." So that's Justice Scalia on preventive detention.
Well, mine is the toughest task ever because it's a very target-rich environment, but also because there are some fairly disparate strands of argument that we heard today, but I will try to tie it together and begin with points made by Deborah, and hopefully I would do no violence in trying to link them together. Let me say, again, in the spirit of candor, I've read the report. I think it's one of those exercises where, you know, my old joke about, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics. This report, to me, is utterly, our conclusions of it, while technically correct, are utterly unresponsive to the most serious criticisms leveled against an exclusive use of a criminal justice system, because, ladies and gentlemen, it ain't leaks, although they do exist, and it ain't the compromise of classified information introduced in the context of SEPA, or even the fact that you cannot gather sort of a, some intelligence in the context of trying people. What do we have here? We have a bunch of cases where the government lawyers, in good faith, consistent with ethics obligations, and consistent with the requirements in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, that to sort of simplify it a bit, before you go down a path of charging somebody with an offense, you need to decide in good faith that you would be able to obtain an indictment and a conviction. So we have the government deciding to prosecute those cases. Good lawyers assigned to it, very able, very hardworking people, believing that it has sufficient evidence, believing at the outset that it would not need to compromise evidence to obtain conviction that they didn't want to compromise, got it done. Gee, that's really surprising. I would be, you know, I would be appalled if it were otherwise. But that's not the real problem of the criminal justice system, because the successful prosecution of these cases, and by the way, let me also stipulate that it is a lot easier to get to the starting point where you can sort of say, all right, I can go and obtain damn good chances of obtaining conviction. Indictment ain't difficult, but obtaining conviction down the road. The offenses that took place in American soil in a situation where you have evidence, physical evidence or electronic surveillance type evidence that is admissible. Yeah, of course you can prosecute. That evidence is rarely available in the foreign environment because, as I'm sure I'm not the only one who's written about it, but as I somewhat sarcastically pointed out a number of times, I would love to defend a person captured on a foreign battlefield, even with an AK-47 in hand, because by the time that person, you know, stands and faces the jury, DNA contamination, chain of custody, confusion of witnesses, adrenaline pumping, all sorts of other things that take on a battlefield, I would find it very easy to defend this person. We get classified information and all this other stuff. But that actually, ladies and gentlemen, has fundamentally nothing to do. There's a little nitpicks about the use of a criminal justice system. The fundamental problem of a criminal justice system, it is reactive. Okay? It does not allow you to protect the community in a comprehensive, holistic sense. You protect the community from the criminals you identify who pose threat to it, largely after they committed a crime or substantially trotted down the path of committing that crime. And that's okay in the case of ordinary municipal crimes because, again, we are very strong, we are very robust society. We can afford to take the risks that some bank robber is going to rob a bank before we catch him, or at least, you know, does it a couple of times before we catch him, and ditto with a lot of other people. That's not the case with catastrophic style attacks, certainly not the case with attacks involving weapons of mass destruction. It is certainly not the case with attacks originating both in terms of being staged, planned, and largely executed overseas. That is the problem of a criminal justice system. And nothing, absolutely nothing in that study addresses this issue, nor could it, because it's basically what we call a forensic drill down on existing cases. What would be nice, but probably not a fair criticism because the two gentlemen involved couldn't have done it, is to look at all the bloody cases that the government didn't prosecute, even though they knew that there's a bunch of bad people because they didn't have enough evidence or because they could not, because the intelligence community told them don't go down that path because it would compromise for some methods. It's been an interesting study, but such study cannot be done at the unclassified level, and it's difficult to do even at the classified level. A final point before I switch to David Rame's remarks. Look, I am frankly tired of hearing that calling somebody a warrior somehow magically enhances the status of that person, because that is only true if you're calling that person an honorable warrior. Okay, if you're calling this person an unlawful combatant, unlawful belligerent, francotireur, which by the way, all the things are not invented by Bush and Cheney. You go back hundreds of years in our history, ours, not necessarily American, but Western history. These are really, really bad people. They're criminals, but they're more than that. Okay? They're more than that. They're enemies of humanity. They're like pirates, like slave traders. You give them no, you accord them no dignity to call them that. And the critics who claim otherwise are usually the people who deny that they're such a beastie as unlawful enemy combatants. Because in their book, you're either a lawful enemy combatant upon capture who becomes POW, or you're a civilian. So if you call somebody a combatant, therefore you call that person an honorable soldier. That ain't the case. And last, I mean, in some sense, it's almost narcissistic. Do you really think these people care what we call them? Do you don't think that they have well-developed, and I'll get in a second what I mean by them, but people who engage in those acts, they really care what a bunch of Western prosecutors or jurors or policy officials call them? They know who they are. They know what they call themselves. Okay, the warriors of jihad, et cetera, et cetera. They don't need our validation. Israel, for example, does not call people they capture and prosecute enemy combatants. They don't buy in this model. I would challenge my colleague here to tell me how it lessened the prestige, including the people whom Israel just released as the part of a swap, who venerated and applauded throughout Lebanon and much of the rest of the Arab world as heroes. They were never called warriors. Does that detract from their sex appeal as far as that particular body politic is concerned? Hell no. All right. It's interesting because in some sense, I'll get briefly to Ben with whom my disagreement is somewhat more nuanced, but I cannot disagree with David Rames any more profoundly, but it's a very crisp disagreement because you both, in my opinion, incorrectly state what the true goals of the jihadists are. And I've never been to Yemen, and I can't profess to discuss this with many people. But I've certainly read, I used to be a Soviet expert back in my pre-lawyer years, and I made a habit of reading. You cannot be an expert in the Soviet Union unless you read things written by Soviet military and civilian officials, and read books written by communist ideologists. And there's plenty of literature in English translated, so you don't need to do Arabic, that describes what their goals are. And the goals of Islamists or jihadists, whatever you call it, are certainly more than the free points. Withdraw of U.S. forces from Arabia, stop propping up the corrupt regimes and destruction of Israel. No, those goals also include some charming objective as building an emirate first and global caliphate. But hey, you know what? I cannot live with those goals, but it doesn't even matter. That's not the point. To me, it is a classic, so aside from misstating how existentialist their full panoply of their goals is, you don't have to portray them as idiots and irrational beings to treat them as enemies of the United States. Most enemies throughout human history of one side, of one state, of one party, whatever, were rational. They're not insane people. I mean, Hitler was not insane. Mussolini was not insane. You could read Mein Kampf and figure out what their goals were. So to ascribe rationality, you don't need to ascribe irrationality to somebody to use person as an enemy. And with all due respect, there's enormous difference between sympathy, musings, proverbial Swiss grandmothers, sending money to charity. But if you do enough, if you're first of all destined to live in a world where you have entities, some state and some non-state, who engage in a level of violence directed at your body politic, at your society, to create what in international law is known as a state of armed conflict, not an occasional unpleasantness, but a state of armed conflict. And when fortunately we're in that state, I wish it were otherwise. If you live in those times, and you have people who render a support above a certain level, they are no longer sympathizers, they are no longer ill-wishers, they are no longer, you know, material supporters, they do become your enemy. That's how it works, unfortunately, both in the law and reality. And you have to find out some framework for dealing with this. And stipulating that it cannot be too broad, but it cannot be too narrow. And my favorite example is, and again, for those of us who are lawyers, most of us are, and Ben is must have been a lawyer
honorary
prior life, an agency law provides a very good model. If you're dealing with an organization like Al-Qaeda, it doesn't have clear membership roles, and remembering that you don't have to be firing AK-47, you can provide, you know, particular support roles. If you are an Al-Qaeda forger, whose job it is to forge documents for Al-Qaeda, you are an enemy combatant, because as a matter of fact, if you have a job in a normal, you know, military structure, you're don't do forging, but you do other things that, you know, typing, preparing documents, you know, transmitting orders, you would be considered a combatant. If you're on the other hand, for those of you who are aficionados of a David Jackal, you're a commercial forger who forges documents for all comers, you're not a combatant. You can be prosecuted, if at all, on the material support statute. But if you're a full-time forger, if your family is taken care of, if you perish, forgive me, you are a member of Al-Qaeda, and therefore you're a combatant. If all you do is you sit at home and grouse how much you hate George Bush or Republican Party of America as a whole, and that's all you do, or you go on a demonstration and carry slogans, you're not a combatant. Nobody I know seriously claims that mere hostility towards the United States is enough to make you a combatant. But I don't know many people who claim that being an in-house forger for Al-Qaeda is somehow not enough. More is the difficult part. I, by and large, agree with Ben that we unfortunately live in a world where this type of war is going to go for a long time, and the pure military justice paradigm, which envisions minimum of civilian involvement, is not needed. So I would buy pretty much all the concepts contained in this book, provided we have a couple of caveats. And again, I'm reprising many debates and discussions that Ben and I have had over time. As long as you do not completely eviscerate the laws of war paradigm. And by the way, we spent all day here talking about detention. Frankly, ladies and gentlemen, that's not the most important issue. The most important issue is retain the viability of overall laws of war architecture. And let me assure you that they're not well in the Western world. There are far more important issues than actually how many appeals a captured enemy combatant should have. We're talking about things like rules of engagement. We're talking about collateral damage. We're talking about the fact that as far as the rest of the world is concerned, all of our allies, including our British friends, think we use air power too much, okay? We use standoff munitions too much. We use indirect fire too much. We're killing too many Afghanis. We're killing too many innocent Iraqis. There's a real press to move away from a robust kind of an industrial, attrition-oriented American way of waging war. And lots of people, including one of the greatest living military historians, Sir Michael Howard, claim that there's no such thing as a war in a traditional sense anymore. So that, to me, in a time where we're fighting against people who are fighting without any semblance of restraint, who completely reject any notion of, you know, not attacking civilians or not pretending to be civilians, who are happy to fight out of mosques and churches and synagogues and committed brutalities and levels we have not seen for centuries, for us to unilaterally abandon our ability to use the traditional
key parameters of the laws of war architecture, which detention is just one building block, would be suicidal. And I am very worried that if we do not watch ourselves, that's exactly what we're going to find ourselves to be. So I'm all in favor of National Security Court and a bit more supervision. And I've been written a long time before Boumediene, but in my mind, after several years worth of detention, there has to be some level of judicial Article III type engagement. But we have to be very careful to make sure that we don't do it in a way that eviscerates the basic integrity of a law of war paradigm, because otherwise we're in very bad shape. Thank you.
Okay, it's 4:15. We have 15 minutes left. I'm not going to ask any questions because we have so little time left. I do want to give any of the panel members, except for David, since he went last, a chance to respond if they would like. David or Deborah or Ben, you want to say anything more?
Just go to questions.
Yeah. How about you, David?
I'd like to
go ahead.
A couple of things. The first is that the whole idea of preventive detention based on a prediction of dangerousness just reminds me of Minority Report too much. And I use that as one caution, even though it's sort of lighthearted. The more serious examples are the Japanese internment, where the justification there was entirely preventive, that these Japs, is what they called them, are loyal to the emperor and will commit acts of sabotage and spying, and therefore en masse needed to be rounded up. And similarly, in the Red Scare after World War I, the fact that you were an anarchist or an immigrant, just an immigrant, meant you could be rounded up for preventive purposes so that you wouldn't be throwing bombs at police stations. So this idea of preventive detention and the preventive theory of detention troubles me a great deal. Second of all, this idea of honorable soldiers leaves me cold. When Rumsfeld said back in 2002 that the men in Guantanamo weren't entitled to the protections of the Geneva Conventions, my first thought was, do you mean that Nazi soldiers were entitled to more protections, that these people are even worse than Nazi soldiers? I don't believe in that concept. I don't believe that there's anyone in combat or otherwise who is worthy of fewer protections than Nazi soldiers. Pirates had habeas rights. And then as to the question of who would say that sitting at home and knitting with evil thoughts in your head would ever be enough to be considered an enemy combatant, I go back to what the government itself said in the argument before Judge Joyce Hens Green back in 2004 when we were arguing about whether or not the prisoners had any right to habeas corpus and whether or not they had any due process rights and so forth. And she tested the government's theory of who could be an enemy combatant. And famously, she asked, do you mean to tell me that a little old lady in Switzerland who gave some money to a charity that gave some money to Al-Qaeda could be an enemy combatant? And the government lawyer said, yes. You are teaching the children of a Taliban leader how to speak English. Could that be an enemy combatant? Yes. I don't think one can. I do think that it's a very important enterprise if you're going to use the war paradigm to say precisely who an enemy combatant is with great clarity and great specificity. And it's not as bounded as David might suggest. So I think I'll leave it right there.
Can I just say very briefly, 10 seconds. First of all, let's stipulate that lawyers occasionally, good lawyers, say stupid things in response to questions from judges. I'm so tired of hearing this example because nobody I know defends it. Point number one. Point number two, of all due respect, and I consider myself somewhat of a student of the laws of war, it's not a question of ideology. It's not a question on whose behalf you're fighting. But yes, regular Nazi soldiers war lawful combatants would only be prosecuted for individual violations on an individual basis. Unlawful enemy combatants who do not comply with the 4 or 5 criteria are not. And as a lawyer, you can appreciate that process matters, and it's not just how ill-intentioned you are. So sorry, the most junior of the Taliban members has fewer rights under the laws of war,
by the most senior of the Nazi generals. That's how laws of war work, because laws of war reflect the underlying reality. But in the long run, unlawful irregular combatants pose a greater danger of atrocities and killing of civilians than even the most vicious regular militaries. That's what the structure reflects, that historically based insight.
I want to, at the risk of marginalizing myself from all decent society, say a few words in defense of the idea of preventive detention, which both the David to my left and Deborah have correctly pointed out is limited in the context of, in the numerous contexts in which it shows up in American law. In general, preventive detention based on dangerousness is something and dangerousness. So, for example, in the pretrial detention context, it's a criminal charge and dangerousness. In the case of mental illness, it's a mental illness and dangerousness. And in the case of immigration, where it's actually most pervasive and is quite dramatically pervasive, actually, and nobody cares, which is kind of interesting. It's being in the United States illegally, either never having been admitted, and dangerousness. So you have some dual trigger. Now, the system that I envision has a similar dual trigger, which is, you know, some degree, and this would, you know, require a lot of legislative definition of affiliation slash membership slash operating on behalf of an organization against which Congress has authorized the use of force, and individual dangerousness. And so it actually tracks that structure that in the other context in which we use preventive detention is fairly well accepted, relatively closely. Now, since I wrote the book, I've even actually toyed with the idea of adding a third trigger to it, with a third prong to the trigger, which is the sort of non-feasibility, a judicial certification of the non-feasibility of criminal trial at this time, so that you could have some combination of sort of, you know, the guy's an al-Qaeda operative, he's individually he's individually dangerous, and we can't try him. So now, just to finish the point, I'm always sort of in the position of kind of, as I say, marginalizing myself from decent society by defending preventive detention. But if you take a look at the Human Rights First Zabel Benjamin report, about which I'm, by the way, much more positive in general than David Rifkin is, I actually think the difference between me and Zabel and Benjamin, perhaps, if not Human Rights First, is actually somewhat less than initially meets the eye. So if you look at page 2 of the report, the authors write, "We are, of course, keenly aware that the U.S. armed forces are presently fighting on multiple fronts against al-Qaeda and other Islamist extremist terrorist groups that intend to commit acts of violence against the United States. As part of ongoing military operations, soldiers and sailors will capture and detain enemy fighters without punishing them in order to disable them from fighting against the United States. This is both lawful and fundamental to the effective prosecution of war, and it does not generally implicate the criminal justice system." So in other words, the only real difference between what I'm arguing and what the authors of this study are arguing is that I want to create a specialized set of rules for preventive detentions that we both recognize are going to happen. We're talking about the form in which it's going to happen, not realistically whether it's going to happen.
Okay, questions from the audience?
The way in which Mr. Willis envisions this preventive court hasn't come on the table as such, but that has a bit of a politicization issue. And it goes as follows. If you look at the comparison between the Ramzi Youssef case and the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed case, that in both instances we're prosecuting people for more or less the same. Florida, the National Security Court, the Defendant Court, and so on and so on, these people carried a certain political load. Yes, when there's love. What makes them different from any other criminal capable of doing the same acts as the people for National Security Court? I mean, everyone, me for instance, with a very significant amount of money, could be able to actually execute a terrorist attack. But it's the motivation that leads them to being for National Security Court. I mean, that's the whole problem.
Yeah, it's a very fair question, and I can't answer it for David, but I'll tell you what I think. I think the difference is that, you know, you had an act of Congress that Congress has not revisited, which authorized the use of military force against al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and that's not true of, say, the United States militia movement, of which Timothy McVeigh was associated with when he bombed the Murrah building. And so I do think, you know, you can imagine a world in which the absence of ongoing military conflict overseas renders the authority kind of dormant for long periods of time because there's no organization to which you're, you know, actively prosecuting a conflict. But I do think when you have an authorization to use force like that, that puts those organizations and countries in a very different category than, you know, any organization that may want to engage in violence.
Let me just add one thing. I agree actually what Ben said, but in some sense the proof is in the pudding. It's always the case in war that there may be many potential enemies, many potential countries, let's say in a traditional war, that wish us ill. But one or two more decided to go and do something about it. So, and typically that's what makes war a little bit different from just brigandry and robbery. They're something more than just pecuniary interest most of the time. So yes, there's an ideology. There's ideology involved in World War I, not as crisp as in World War II. If we ever were in a shooting war with the Soviet Union, of course there would have been ideology on their side. So to me, it's not disabling that there is a political component here. As long as you all agree, we're not prosecuting anybody for political beliefs. We're prosecuting people who are actually animated by political or religious beliefs of both, or some other grievance or some other ism, have joined together to bring war to the United States. And we're just fighting back. And the last point I would say is it's interesting. Does anybody disagree that one of the problems, and I'll be the first one to admit it, but the traditional, the war is over, let's release them paradigm is, do we capture tomorrow every single member of al-Qaeda, and let's say we got them all and there's no new recruitment, and put them all together for 2 or 3 years, and 2 or 3 years is enough to vitiate AUMF or even a more customary international law test in terms of their state of armed conflict. What happens if we let them go? Does anybody think that they're not going to go back and reconstitute themselves and start fighting again? So from that perspective, Ben's preventive detention does have a lot to recommend because a lot of times we are literally capable of both crushing but also reconstituting the threat depending on what we do. That's the peculiar nature of this threat.
Evidence and whatnot, and the fact that soldiers are not trained in collecting evidence. FBI agents, as the level of violence goes down and these and these new systems are built up, you see foresee a transition from the need to use law of war to using tradition type of paradigm?
Well, very briefly, in some respects, it's a truism. If a given theater of operation sees the decrease in the level of violence below the level of armed conflict, the laws of war would not apply. I wish I was as optimistic as you are, because as things have gotten bad in Iraq, things are not great in Afghanistan, and the next thing problem, unfortunately, is close to being upon us, is the border areas with Pakistan. I'm unfortunately assuming, and maybe I'm too much of a pessimist, we're in this pickle for decades to come. And it would always be some, let's call them badlands, where the level of violence would be sufficient to amount to an armed conflict. And also, we're always going to unfortunately have some people who are going to try to come here and strike an American homeland. And therefore, I don't know if we disagree, but yeah, if a violence stops, you don't need to use the laws of war, at least in this particular fear.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, I'm going to ask one last question, even though it's 401. And that is, if we certainly have a hybrid system now where we do some criminal law prosecutions where we apply the law of war to the detention system and to some prosecutions. One of the interesting intersections, of course, is what happens after a military commission acquits a Guantanamo defendant of war crimes charges, or a convicted defendant like Mr. Hamdan finishes serving his sentence, which he will very soon. Logically, and the administration has preserved this position, I think it's a possibility, under the law of war, you could continue to detain Hamdan or an acquitted Guantanamo defendant till the end of the war. Do any of you think it's realistic to do that in the real world, and how do you think that kind of dilemma should be resolved? Anyone want to speak to that?
Well, I think it'll depend on who gets elected president, one thing. I think it's possible that if McCain is elected president, he'll choose to keep Hamdan on this theory that even if you weren't convicted of a specific crime, you can still be dangerous and therefore liable to being held. I'm not sure what Obama will do with that.
And Van Nuys, go ahead.
I don't know how to predict what will happen with respect to this. I do think if you want the military commissions to have integrity and to be understood to have integrity, you can't hold people after they serve their sentences as given to them by those military commissions. And as a consequence, I would, as a normative matter, I would argue that Hamdan should be released at the end of his sentence. The caveat to that, which I just note as a thought puzzle, not because it undermines my sense of what the right answer is, but I do think if you think about the incentive structure that creates, when you're looking at a detainee who you could bring to trial in a military commission, it creates an enormous incentive not to try. Because so if you have KSM and you haven't, say, filed charges against him yet, you say KSM's a bad example because he won't get acquitted. But a detainee who may get acquitted, who may get a short sentence, and you say, well, if I bring him to trial, he may get a five-month sentence that he's a net five-month sentence, and then I'll have to let him go. But if I don't bring him to trial, then I can hold him forever. And so it actually creates a very perverse, what I think is the right answer, creates a very perverse incentive structure for the administration.
I would just agree with Ben on this. It undermines the credibility and the legitimacy of the military commission system if you continue to hold somebody after they've served their sentence. And I also agree that it changes the incentive structure. And that's one of the problems that I have with the system of preventive detention. If that is permissible, then it changes the incentive structure within the criminal justice system as well. Why should the government ever try anybody if they can more easily preventively detain them? And so that's another problem with a new system of preventive detention.
The risk of being missed, as Deborah would stipulate, that most of the critics think that military commissions are such
illegitimate institutions, it's pretty difficult to see what one can do to further delegitimize them, but that's maybe a low blow. But I would say this. I agree with Ben as a practical matter. Amnon would be let go. That is probably true of most people who are going to be tried by military commissions. Ironically enough here, and it just shows you that it's driven by political reality, ironically enough, and I'm curious if David Ames disagrees with me, the level of evidentiary and other, you know, proofs and burdens that, you know, evolved in the context of Hamdan's military commission surely would be sufficient on the most rigorous habeas standard to sustain his detention as an enemy combatant. Would you not agree that an average district court judge would say, well, given what you put forward, and you remember, the military jury gave him a very small sentence, in part because of some prosecutorial mistakes, but in part because they didn't think that he was kind of a dangerous guy, you know, not a big warrior, but none of them had any doubts that he was Bin Laden's bodyguard and driver, and not a guy who served Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda leader, not Bin Laden, the, you know, farmer carrying around the crops. So it seems to me that the burden, I mean, that should be enough to hold him.
Well, I'd say the head of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said of the Hamdan verdict that they convicted a truck driver of driving a truck. And, you know, in terms of the material support conviction, that's what it boils down to.
But driving a truck doesn't, in the military system, driving a truck, a German, you know, Wehrmacht truck driver was kept as a POW together with the most, you know, virile and powerful German infantry soldier. I mean, just because you're driving a truck does not immunize you. Where is this notion you have to be plunging bayonets and shooting guns to be a combatant? I mean, he drove a truck for a senior general on the other side. How is that not a... Forget the label part. Is that not a combatant-like behavior?
We'll have more seminars like this.
Well, yeah, it wasn't an indefinite detention. Okay, I want to thank all of the members of the panel for an invigorating discussion, and thank you ladies for hanging around all day. I think Adam has a couple of remarks.
We just give everyone a quick round of applause. So thank you for coming today. It's been a great conference. Thank you all for attending. There are a lot of upcoming events on similar topics. Flyers are outside. Again, thank you all. Thank our panelists, and you all have a great weekend.
We agree, right? I don't bother with me.
Of course you do.
No, but all I'm saying is,
congratulations.
You love being the defense analyst, mind you. Trust me.
We never charged Hitler's cook. We never charged his driver.
No, because but believe me, if we captured him, it's not a question of charging. If we captured Hitler's cook in the early stages of the war,
well, if we would have treated Hamdan like a POW, that would have been okay with me.
Suggest that the choices between the USA and a POW.
You can't fall outside of protection.
Well, you have to know. Geneva protection. Geneva Conventions practice an air law for a living. Geneva Conventions to me is like the 1990 Clean Air Act.